I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of a very insightful, poetic book, Ian Brown. He is the author of 60, A Diary of My 61st Year, The Beginning of the End or The End of the Beginning. Ian is an author and a feature writer for the Globe and Mail in Toronto. He's written a number of award-winning books. Maybe some of you have read his book, The Boy in the Moon, A Father's Search for His Disabled Son. It was named one of the New York Times' 10 best books of the year. He is also author of Freewheeling and Man Overboard. And 60 is, as the title indicates, a diary of the day that he turned 60 until the day that he turned 61. It's an account of the many changes, the physical, mental, and emotional changes that come to all of us when we age. He kept a diary documenting each day of this 61st year on Earth, his failures, his friends, family, the death of his father, his sex life, what he's reading, how he spends an embarrassing amount of time every day thinking about who is younger and who is older. If you are 60 or older, his thoughts will no doubt resonate. If you are younger, he says, pay attention while you can. Grasp however small or large or private or public, something that makes you glad to have your time on Earth. And it probably makes sense to read a book about turning 60 when you're turning 30 or 40. But we tend not to do that. We'll figure that out. It's we're trying to find him right now, so bear with me for a moment here as I talk a little bit further. But I really like this book very much. I found myself with a Cubs game on in the background, because that's what my husband was watching, as he needs to. I just found myself thinking a whole lot about turning 60 and also about life, that you find these moments from earlier in your life. I don't know if you find this to be true. The older you get, when you're thinking about, they just sort of come to you, this flash of a moment that appeared when you were 25 or 26 and how it influenced you and sometimes how you can remember it very, very clearly. He feels, Ian does, that there are big chunks of his life that he kind of missed, like 20 years, two decades. What happened to those two decades? He writes very movingly about his son, Walker, who is severely disabled, and it was very, very difficult for Ian and his wife, Joanna, to raise Walker, and he's now living in an assisted living situation outside of Toronto because they can no longer care for him. He writes about his father and his father's death and how his father aged. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we're tracking him down now. And I would think that we'll have a lot of interesting calls from you. Those of you who have turned 60, did you find it to be in a momentous time? Did you worry about turning a corner here and reaching a time where you don't have as much time left? And what it did to you to start thinking about physical limitations, perhaps, or starting to see a whole series of specialists, or finding yourself to no longer be in the heyday of your life, which perhaps was a different decade, or maybe it may have been your 60s. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We got him good. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. I think we'll have a lot of calls on this. And Ian is with us now. Hi, Ian. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm great. I love your book, and I'm older than you are, so that may be some comfort to you, because I know you're always looking at people.
That has to have something going for it, doesn't it?
I guess so, although maybe I want to be your age again. It is interesting, though, and I do this, too. You reach a certain age, and you start looking at everybody saying, are you younger than I am, or are you older than I am? I know you do that quite a bit. The book is just filled with so much, what you're reading and poetry and all that you do. But let's start with the story of your father, because I really thought about that a lot, too. And your father, how he aged and what you took in your soul from watching him age.
He was very old when he died. He was 98. And he, was a very graceful and fit guy, kind of a world-class athlete, and worked till he was 97, going in three times a week at that point in time. He played squash till he was 88. And he was lucky in that he had a kind of rectangularized life. You know, he stayed at a high level for quite a long time and then had a short, sharp decline. But I have to say, for the past, the last 4 years, he really hated getting older.
Mm-hmm.
He hated being dependent to the extent he was, although he lived alone after my mother died in a, you know, community. And he was very, he hated, I think, you know, being graceless or feeling dependent. And the, what struck me about it was how much he considered aging to be a failure. And it was really the first time I'd ever noticed that, that he really seemed to think that getting old was some kind of, that it was A, his fault, and that B, it was a form of failure. And I do think that idea is encouraged, especially by the commercial world. You know, as consumers, I mean, you know, I'm, what am I now, 61-ish, 62, and, you know, I bought a cast iron frying pan the other day. And as I was buying it, I thought to myself, this is probably the last cast iron frying pan I'm going to buy.
Oh, no.
You think,
right.
No, they last forever, right?
I know.
And I'm driving a Prius, you know, and I think, is that really the last car I'm going to own, right? A Prius? But, and so as a consumer, you know, I need less stuff. So as a consumer, I probably am a failure because, or at least I'm less successful to corporations because of my age. But in every other way, you know, you, once you start reading it and looking into it, as I did to write this diary, you know, artists, painters, musicians, thinkers, I would venture, I mean, I don't know exactly statistically, but at least half the well-known artists and accomplished people of our, that we know, you know, everybody from Matisse to Hockney to, you know, the Rolling Stones, they do some of their best work after 50 and 60 and in some cases after 70. And it really struck me that my dad saw his, and you know, I guess he only measured success in one way. And in that way, he was less successful. And it really, and the other guy, I won't go on long here, but the other thing he said to me, towards the end of my of his life was, you know, don't get old. And I kept wondering what he meant by that, because of course everybody gets old. But I think what he was trying to say was he was asking me to forgive him. And I think he was suggesting, you know, I realized that if I could forgive, you know, and there was nothing to forgive. I mean, I didn't hold it against him, but he was asking for forgiveness. And I think if you can be decent to somebody who's older, you can possibly expect somebody to be decent to you,
yes.
Which I guess is the, you know, something we should aim for.
Yeah, I love that. We should be decent. We tend to not look at people who are old. But it's funny, my dad said the same. My dad lived to 93, and actually, some of the best times I had with him were, and you had this with your dad too, he was just a great companion at the end, and we had great talks, and he would say to me, he didn't say, don't get old, he'd say, don't get really old, Kathy. And and when I looked at him and saw the condition he was in, I could understand why he was saying that, don't get really old. And I think your dad had some of the humiliation, the physical humiliation that can come with being very old.
Yes, you know, he was an Englishman. I'm very sort of stiff upper lip type. And I remember him saying to me at one point in the company of my mother, you know, after 70, you know, I mean, you know, he would complain about, you know, not being as quick as he could be or not being, you know, his eyesight, having to wear glasses. And all. As I say, he had very high physical standards.
Yes.
I remember him saying, you know, I don't, you know, after 80, forget it. You know, you just ended at 80. And my mother said, well, actually, you know, you had quite a good time in Aruba last year when you were 88. You know? And I thought, you know, but and the other thing, what you just said reminded me of, you know, when you are looking after somebody, and I looked after him for the last 5 years, I guess, of his, last 3 years of his life, after my mother died. And, you know, he lived in town, and it would take me 20 minutes to go and see him. And I used to go out there and take them shopping before she died. And I have to admit that I did say to myself, my God, what a pain this is. You know, I didn't resent it, but But, it seems like a burden. But now, looking back on it, I realize that that was the time when I actually got to know them best.
Mm-hmm.
And so his dependency, in some ways, was a gift to me.
Mm. So you talk about this, is this my last Prius? Is this my last pan that I'm going to buy that's going to last forever? You say at one point, and I hope you don't feel this a whole lot, and how do you guard against it? You feel sometimes, I've run out of time. I have to pick and choose. What book am I going to read? I don't have that many years left. What vacation am I going to take? Which story will I write? Which conversations? What friends am I going to see? Do you think about that every day, Ian?
I think about it. I did think about it quite a lot, especially as I set out on this year, the year that I turned 60. I kept thinking of that. Woody Allen once said that he as he was getting older and he wanted to read more, because he was running out of time. So he took a speed reading course and he read War and Peace. And somebody said, "Oh, that's great. What's it about?" And he said, "It's about Russia." And that's
great.
That's the problem, of course, of trying, because you do that actuarial thing, you say, well, what'll I do, and where will I go, and how can I pack it all in? And I found, as I was conducting that actuarial analysis, I kept trying to pack more in, and that made me skip over details. And the thing is, if you skip over details, you mm-hmm. deny your episodic memory of nutrition, and so you really do remember. It's like being stressed all the time, and you really do not remember what has happened. And one of the great byproducts of keeping this diary was that it made me slow down, and it made me paradoxically or counterintuitively concentrate more on fewer things. So instead of reading, The Odyssey and Moby Dick and War and Peace, I just pick one and I keep reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in that way, by concentrating more on less and going deeper on a narrower range of stuff, it actually turns out to be more satisfying. And I think it was keeping the diary that actually made me do that, because every day, I had to, this sort of continuous regimen. And what astonishes me, I've been talking a bit about this book around, and when I go and talk to a group of people, maybe there's 100 people in the room, and if I say to them, how many of you keep a diary? Never does more than 4 people put up their hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that really surprises me, because, we have this brief flash of light, between the darkness we're born out of and the darkness we die into. And you would think that paying attention
yes.
to what's going on would be to what has happened to you, no matter how insignificant it seems. But I think the problem is people think that, as with getting older, things are supposed to go a certain way. You're supposed to think this way. You're supposed to act that way, as opposed to what actually occurs and what actually strikes you as meaningful and true. And the great advantage of writing a diary and slowing down and paying attention, more attention to less, is that you get to concentrate on, I found, on those true moments. So I'm almost at the point where I feel like I should be proselytizing and saying, keep a diary.
I know. Well, I've done that. No sooner was I reading, I didn't finish all of it, but I read a whole lot of your book that I wrote to my son, who's in Mexico right now. And I just wrote him about your book, and I said, you've got to read this now. He's 24 years old. And I'm thinking, you've got to do this when you're 24. Please, please, for your mom, please do this. And you're
That's
the inspiration
right.
for that. But it's true. You read your book and you say, pay attention now. Your heyday might be your 20s. It might be your 30s. It may not be your 50s or your 60s, right?
That's right. Well, my wife, Johanna, who's a very good writer and very successful writing, she herself, when she was in her 30s, said, my heyday is going to be my 50s. That'll be great, my heyday. But and now that she's in her 50s and is rushing about, a life of details and trying to catch up and stay up and stay ahead and stuff, she said, I now realize, said the other day, my heyday was in my 30s, and I didn't I was too busy, in a way, to notice it.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of poetry in your book. You write poetic passages as well. You spend quite a bit of time in the first part of the book, and I got to admit, and I feel embarrassed to tell you this, Ian, but I had never heard of this writer before, and now I'm scrambling to find out about him. Do I pronounce his name correctly? Knausgård?
Yeah, it's you actually pronounce the K. It's Karl Ove Knausgård.
Knausgård.
And, yeah, he's relatively unknown.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that.
and he's Norwegian. And he wrote in Norwegian, and he wrote this series of books that it's called My Struggle. And there are six of them in all. And I believe five have been translated into English at this point. They're all quite long. And it's basically a diary of his life from not told in chronological order, but, you know, what he remembers of it, a kind of Proustian thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty interesting. What I found gripping about it in the first part of my diary, they're very long books, but what I found gripping was his lack of apology for writing about the way his life occurred before him. And I really do, I think one of the great gifts of getting old, and I never thought I'd say this, but, you know, he writes about what happens, and he does not worry about whether it's acceptable, presentable. He puts down what has happened and tries to stick to what is true. And I must say that has been, as I said before, you know, that's the thing you most want to do, because there's so much pressure in our lives to conform to something that doesn't actually feel authentic. And as you get older, as I turn 60, I mean, when I wrote this, I'm a journalist, right, by training, so
right.
I'm used to writing about what's supposed to be important, what other people tell me is important, you know, what is supposed to be in the news. But I found that by keeping a diary, I actually wrote about all these intimate, personal, private details. And my fear was that, you know, I was just getting older, I was becoming more internal rather than external, and that none of these very private, personal details would connect with other people. But what I found is that those personal and private and intimate details, those are the things that everybody notices. Those are actually the universal things. And what that suggests to me, and I can only admit this now that I'm, you know, I'm past 60, is that those are the things, the most personal, the most intimate things, those
yes.
are the things that make us all equal. They're
mm-hmm.
the things that make us the same and therefore equal.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, but I find that reassuring.
Right. And it's also important that you wrote this, I think, because as you acknowledge in the book, the amount of literature about what is true about being 60 or 70, for that matter, is sparse.
Yes. It really, I mean, to my surprise, because it's a very rich subject. I mean, there are classic examples of it. Philip Larkin is a brilliant, the brilliant British poet who wrote such poems as, The Old Fools, which is about advanced aging and really is a harrowing.
Yes.
Do not attempt that at home alone.
Right.
But he, you know, he wrote Obad about worrying about dying in the middle of the night. Sharon Olds has just written a new book of poems called Odes, which is a brilliant, brilliant work about a woman getting older. But there are people like May Sarton, who's a British poet who became an American, and you know she wrote a book at the diary at 70.
Hmm.
She wrote another one that she thought she was dying at 79, so she wrote something called Endgame, I think. But then it turned out she wasn't dying, so she wrote one at 81 and at 83. But they're pretty few and far between, which surprises me again because I think that might be a reflection of this concern we have, you know, that our lives are kind of over before they're really over. You know, we think, oh, well,
we're past it now. We should just fade into the woodwork. Whereas, in fact, at 60, you're finally brave enough to talk about the stuff that actually happened.
Right. And beautifully, you write about it as well. Ian Brown is our guest this hour. His latest book is 60, A Diary of My 61st Year, The Beginning of the End or The End of the Beginning, already nominated for a number of awards. And his other books, his most recent book is The Boy in the Moon, A Father's Search for His Disabled Son. He writes about his son some in this diary as well. And the at least decade of his life that was spent raising a very disabled son. It's quite moving. Well, what do you want to talk about, everybody? You want to talk about what the physical changes are? Do you want to talk about how you can imagine the end while you're in the middle of the whole thing? And if you knew, that's the darn thing about getting old, is you learn all these things. And as Ian said, you know, pay attention to those moments, because when you get to be 60 or above 60, you're thinking, darn, I can't remember all the details of that wonderful event that took place. And you wish you could just find it in a diary somewhere and really enrich your life when you're 60 by what happened, because you live a lot of life by the time you're in your 60s. At any rate, he writes about all kinds of things, growing bald. He writes about heart changes and physical changes and nutrition and sex lives and marriages and crushes you may have on people when you're in your 60s, or thoughts you may have about younger people in an amorous fashion, even though they probably wouldn't give you a second glance because they think of you as a grandparent. You know, all of this stuff, very genuine, very honest. So take the conversation in any direction. Plus, he does these neat things. You know how you read a book and you think, oh, I'm going to do that. He does these mini readings every day now, and he puts thoughts on, you know, the thing, the cardboard thing that you put in a shirt. If you get it from the dry cleaner, he writes them on there, those thoughts, and he's going to make some artistic display at some point. Isn't that a great idea? So he stuffs them all in a shelf he's got. I like that. Mini readings every day. That's good. Well, here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Okay, our phone lines are jammed for Ian. Let's start with Joanne in Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you today?
Fine.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Joanne.
I just wanted to say, he turned 60, but for those of us, we're 60 as far in the rearview mirror, and 70 is becoming a lot clearer. I want to say, go for it. I've started a third career, and I'm happy about that, and I have pretty good health, and even if it deteriorates, I know I have a purpose. So that's what you do when you hit 60 and start moving forward. You find a purpose, you aim for it, and you keep right on going.
And how are you feeling, Joanne? You got aches and pains when you turn 60 or not?
I get aches and pains, but I still play tennis.
Good.
And I still exercise, and most of the aches and pains come after tennis. But sometimes it's harder to get out of a chair, but then I just say, I'm going to do it, and I stand up. And sometimes I have my son help me stand up. But,
right.
You know,
yeah.
it's just part of aging, and you move forward, and if you find yourself with a passion and a purpose, then getting older is just getting older.
Ian, what do you say?
I think that is absolutely, absolutely correct. One of the difficulties, of course, is that, you can ping when you're new to it, as I like to think of myself as being. You know, a newcomer. I'm a young old person. the difficulty is, you know, you keep pinging between sort of over time. You know, in history, there have been two main reactions to people getting older. One is delusion, and one is depression. And you can sort of ping between the depression of woe is me and the delusion of I'm never going to die, and that's pretty exhausting. In and of itself, but absolutely. And I guess one of the difficulties is one tends to deny it, right? I mean, everybody denies it. And I think the reason we deny it is we don't want to admit that we actually have very little control over what happens to us. I mean, over how we're going to die, or especially
right.
over how quickly we're going to decline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's But denying things is not the right way to go. As you know, your caller just said, I mean, you have to face it head on and say, face your potential fragility, which allows you to use it as opposed to just pretend it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about something that all three of us have in common. I know Joanne, so I know she shares this as well, and you do as well, Ian, that we have children. The children are out of the house. They're grown. Even in your case, Ian, the dog is old. My dog is almost 13, and so I have to kind of carry him around, and he reminds me that I'm old because he's old. This sense of things being away from us, things are gone. But you have this beautiful passage where you write about young children on the beach. It's just poetic, Ian. It's so beautiful. You continue to see new life and excitement and exploration among the very young, even though those you have raised are out of the house now.
Yes, they are. I think that's that's the biggest challenge, is not to miss the world that has not yet occurred. You know, it's almost like,
yes,
there are craven moments in my life when I actually think to myself, oh, I won't be around for the greatest model of the cell phone, you know, which you'll be able to. I have pre-technological pre-mourning in some sort of way. But I think for me, the most, and I don't know if I know what the answer is, except to keep writing maybe, or to keep committing as Joanne has. But the difficulty is not to pre-mourn your absence. You know, I said to somebody the other day, a guy who is a great singer who has inoperable brain cancer. I said, "Will you miss your kids?" And he said, "Well, I won't know, will I? Because of course I'll be dead." He said, "But the thought of missing my kids is absolutely crushing." But at the same time, while he was on tour, on his tour bus, he had his son with him, so he didn't have to miss him.
Oh. Joanne, how do you respond to that, having people grown now?
Well, you know, I miss them because they're not around as much as they used to be, but I keep in contact with them, and I like to hear about what they're doing, and right. I'd like to spend more time with them. But now that I've found a new passion and direction for my life, they're getting interested in what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So they ask me, "Mom, how's your film coming?" and all that sort of thing. And it's what I call my third chapter.
Good.
So I'm gonna live it and do it with gusto.
You go do it. You go do it, Joanne. Good for you. Thank you. Thanks
okay.
for calling.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Mallory next in Madison. Hi, Mallory.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey. Today I was just sharing with the producer, today is my birthday. I'm turning 33.
Happy birthday, Mallory.
But I have an interesting perspective. I my mother passed away from breast cancer when she was 45, and I carry the same gene that she had. And so I've been facing death and life and legacy my entire life since she was first diagnosed.
Mm.
And it's really shaped my life into looking at things like, I want to finish everything on my bucket list, and I'm in my 20s. And it's now become, since I've received the test results of the genetic test, it's turned into, what do I want my legacy in my life to be, and how can I shape this world while I'm still here, and how can I make the world a better place, and what is my role in making the world a better place? And it's been such an optimistic, beautiful way of looking at it, and it sounds melancholy, but it's actually quite hopeful in embracing that idea.
Mm. Ian.
Well, I think that is an almost unbelievably mature attitude. You little brat is what I want to say. You know, because you're still in your 30s and you figured this out. That's absolutely. It doesn't strike me as melancholy. I mean, the gravity of your situation, the potential gravity, of course, is very serious, but in some ways it has freed you, you know, to see time as the rushing thing it is. And I think that's an admirable, I mean, you could lie down and do the woe is me
act as well. But I would say that if only we could somehow get a sense of how important it is to act, regardless of whether it's going to work out or not, or whether you're going to fail or not, all these things, you know, make us not act. If only we could get a sense of the gravity of and how extraordinary and rare our time here on Earth is. I mean, and especially if we could do it without, you know, without having, as you say, a grave health issue looming over you. But I think the human race is, in some ways, we're not very good at planning ahead. You know, that seems to be our big weakness. And most of us who aren't forced into it shy away from that confrontation. But I admire you very much.
Yes.
for the way you've done it.
I do too, Mallory. Thank you so much for calling, and have a wonderful birthday.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. Tell me about these mini readings. I really like the idea, and we'll probably copy it in my life. The mini readings that you do every day, and what you do with those readings. I love it.
Well, I wake up. I used to read the newspaper every morning, and that made me basically suicidal. Then I started reading my email in the morning, and that made me homicidal. So I thought, I'm not going to start the day with something bad. I'm going to find a piece of prose or a piece of poetry every morning, and I'm going to start the day. And so I get up and I take my shower, and while I'm, you know, wandering around collecting myself, I go to my bookshelf and I just pick something, and I find something that moves me. Then I write it down on a shirt cardboard, and my hope is to turn these shirt cardboards with the stuff that's written down on them, they become backgrounds for paintings. It's a very weird idea.
I like it. It's great.
I'm still not sure why I do it, but it is a great way of starting the day with something that, you know, goes into you in the proper way. I don't know if you know the writer Nicholson Baker, but he's an American writer, brilliant, brilliant guy, one of my favorites, lives in Maine.
Hmm.
And I once said to him, you know, he gets up every day and writes. And if he's working on a book, you know, I guess that sustains itself. But, you know, he can write for 3 days, and then what he's written doesn't work out. So he gets up every morning, he sits in a particular chair, he puts his feet up in a particular way, he keeps the lights low and touch tights. And I said to him, well, what do you do when you don't have anything to write about or think about? And he said, I revert to the best thing that happened to me, I guess he does this early in the morning, yesterday. And I said, really? I mean, you're that sort of sentimental? And he said, no, but it's interesting. You start with what you think is the best thing, and then you start to debate in your mind, well, was that better than this, or was that actually better because of something else?
Mm-hmm.
And I think of this reading of a text that moves me or gets me somehow every morning as a version of that. It's a way of starting with something that I want to read as opposed to something I don't.
Mm. Well, let's talk about sex a little bit. Do you think that men think about sex and want sex more in their 60s than women do?
I don't know, but I'm of two minds about this. I used to think before I got to 60 that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of women I know who are a little older than me, they would say at 50, they would say, I've become invisible.
Mm.
Nobody looks at me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And at 60, they would say, thank God, my libido has passed me by. I no longer have to worry about sex. And I have to admit that I thought, that does not sound good to me, you know, to not. But the funny thing is that turning 60, my desire changed. And it became, it's probably slightly less insistent than it used to be. And, I guess it might be less reliable. The enactment of desire, in other words, you know, than it used to be. But it's more Catholic, and with small c. It's more wide-ranging. So as before, you know, I was always, say, drawn to, my wife is a sort of slim brunette. I would always be drawn to, you know, slim brunettes.
Mm-hmm.
But
But now you could walk into the room, you know, with a pinwheel beanie on, you know, and I'd come up and say hello. It's not sexual. It's, I think, the eros, you know, that drives sex, but that also drives a desire to learn, that drives your curiosity. I think that eros has actually widened after 60. I'm more curious about more kinds of people. I'm not just in a, and certainly not acting on it, but I'm more curious. If I say in an erotic way, I mean in the kind of the eroticness of knowledge,
right,
as opposed to in a sexual way. Which, and that surprised me. I did not think that would happen, but I'm very glad it has.
Yeah, well, that's a great answer. Let's go to Hank next. Thank you, Mallory, for your call. Hank in Waupun. Hi, Hank.
Hi, and hi to Ian.
Hi, Hank.
I enjoyed the program. One thing that touched me was when you talked about the importance of keeping a diary.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've done, I started in 1990, and I started reading through a one-year Bible, and in the little gaps in the sections there between the dates, I would write like a diary. But instead of a diary to myself, I would pick out a niece or a nephew, and the whole book was dedicated to her. And then I would have what went on in the day, and then when I would read things like Matthew 6:33, seek first the kingdom of God, I would circle it and say, Josh, this is my life verse, or, stuff like that.
Right.
And then, so when I die, they would get it, and they would not, you know, like, if you had a Bible from your great-great-grandfather, usually they didn't write in except births and deaths in the front. And you had no idea about what the person was or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And here, this has not only what happened to me that year, things are slanted to it. I might say, Josh, you know, when your dad and I were young, this was one of our favorite songs, Mustang Sally. Or we used to like to do this after school. Like, give him a little insight.
Right.
So now he has three things. He knows his Uncle Hank.
Right.
He knows his Uncle Hank for a year has been praying for him.
Oh.
About him, and he left him. The whole book is for him.
Mm-hmm.
And him. And plus he has everything that I think about what I've read. Plus I've got to read through the Bible in 1 year.
Yeah, right. It's all good. Hank, you're a sweetheart. Ian.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that. I know a guy who keeps a diary, but he's a car freak. And he's always, you know, buying some old jalopy or some, you know, he just bought recently a secondhand Miata. Not a secondhand, a second-generation Miata. Which is a great sort of car, and then he works on them, and he keeps a diary every day of what happened with the car, and that turns out to be this launching point for him, just as, you know, your reading is every day, the launching point for what he writes in the diary. And I think this goes back to that point of, you know, you start with something specific, and if you do it, you know, if you are patient, the alchemists were the scientists of the Middle Ages, the first scientists. You know, they used to have a motto, patience, courage, and continuous regimen. And as I was keeping my diary, I thought, you know, that's a great motto for a diary keeper, because I'm also trying to turn lead into gold, which is what the alchemists were doing. But it's a great motto because you have to be patient, thinking to yourself, well, I'm going to do what I did yesterday. I'm going to write down this part of the Bible, or I'm going to write about this part of the car, or I'm going to write about what I read this morning, or I'm going to write about the best thing that happened yesterday. I'm going to start there. You have to have courage, you know, to write about what actually happened. But you have to have continuous regimen most of all, because if you keep doing it and you commit to this weird idea, you know, as philosophers have said, you know, if only commits, because there is magic in it. And somehow writing about this same thing every day, the car, the Bible, you know, however you start it, somehow the repetition makes you, it takes you a place you never expected to go. I'm not sure if Hank, if you found the same thing, but certainly that starting with something very specific and regular and reliable gets you going. And then did you find you had liftoff afterwards?
Did I what?
Did you have liftoff?
Did you find you had liftoff? You started writing about stuff you never expected to be writing about?
Not really.
It's so
not
much
really.
For
that. Of course, I've written about other things. I was a journalist for 15 years here.
Hmm.
And so, but that was just separate things. And but plus, I didn't become a journalist till after that. So maybe, a great influence of me was Jack London, and his motto was 5 lines a day.
Hmm.
And that, I could about write that 5 lines in that little space between the dates in the Bible.
Yeah.
And I've got very good at writing postcards because I can be very succinct in, you know, tell a lot in a little postcard. And it helped when I became in journalism because I could make a 3-page story into a 2-paragraph story and still carry most of the essence of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Thanks, Hank, for the call. We need to pause for just a moment and return. This hour, we're talking about 60, a diary of my 61st year, the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning. But, of course, it has great inspiration for people of all ages. Ian Brown is the author. Ian is a highly acclaimed journalist and author. He lives in Toronto. And his book, The Boy in the Moon, A Father's Search for His Disabled Son. His son, Walker, is severely disabled. It was named one of the New York Times' 10 best books of the year and won 3 of Canada's most prestigious awards. He's written other books as well. And this book, 60, has already been nominated for prestigious prizes. So we're taking phone calls, and we have time. Thanks, Hank, so much for your call. To take more, if you'd like to join us, there's a line open. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to Liz in Fitchburg next. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Ian. I wanted to say that I was a late bloomer, and I'm 62 now, and I finally feel like I've grown up. I reinvented my life many times due to a disability, and it seems that when I turned 60, all of a sudden this light bulb went on, and I felt like a grown-up. And I feel like the 60s have been so far wonderful years, and I'm looking forward to many, many more wonderful years. I don't feel old. Every time I look in the mirror, I think, who is that old person? And I realize that that's me. So, you know, it just feels funny to watch my children grow up, but I don't feel like I'm getting any older. So, you know, being older is, I think, a blessing. I look at it as a blessing. It's been good for me.
Ian, is it good for you?
Yeah, I hope I can be as optimistic.
Mm.
I have to admit there are days. I still remember the first time I thought, you know, I am getting older. I was in a meeting at the newspaper where I work. It was a pitch meeting where we pitch our stories, the stories we want to work on, and I just finished reading a book about the early voyages around the tip of South America, around Cape Horn. And so that was in the back of my mind anyway. When I was sitting in this meeting, and a young guy jumped up before my turn came around, and he said, you know, I really want to write a book about gay porn, about homosexual pornography, which he thought was a very important subject. And so I naturally said, oh, Cape Horn, I love Cape Horn. I can't get enough Cape Horn. And you know, he looked at me and he said, what? Really, you don't strike me as the type. I said, oh, come on. You know, what's not to like about Cape? Anyway, this went on for 5 minutes. And finally someone leaned over to me and said, are you saying Cape Horn? Because he's saying gay porn, and they're very different things. And I realized at that point, you know, that my hearing
was going.
Oh,
and
Ian.
That I, you know, to be a journalist, I need to hear things. So I went and got my hearing aid. And, you know, it was, I have to admit that I am vain enough to this day that I wish there were, you know, some of these physical things did not afflict me. That when I looked, you know, because I'm going slightly bald and I now have to use a little bit of hair gel.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Right.
Oh, a couple of weeks ago, I put it into my hands and I started to apply it to my face thinking it was sunblock. Like, this is not a graceful way to start the morning.
I know. But at least you have some hair, and you reminded us that two-thirds of men are bald, mostly bald, by the time they're your age, right?
Well, yes, and you know, and that can be a source of, you know, even at my age, I can, to this day, if I saw somebody who he could be 25 years younger than me, but if he's more bald than I am, I will look at him and I will think, oh, look at that poor guy and how much closer to death he is.
Oh, Ian. The thing that I think you're paying a little too much attention to is your resting heart rate. I mean, there are a lot of parts in the book where you're kind of obsessed with your heart rate. Don't you think?
Yes.
Yes,
no, no, my heart rate, it comes up incessantly. And I, you know, I cut out a lot of that stuff when I do.
That's funny. Liz, thank you so much for your call. And let's go to Randy in Sauk County. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. This is something I've thought about a lot for whatever reason. I raised a big family and find myself alone all the time now at 65. And you know, I tell you what my feeling is. You would think I would be this depressed, lonely, sad little person. Mm. And actually, I have a motto on my email page and a couple of nice photos of me out doing my jog in the morning and my little exercise routine and whatever. And I have a motto that says, a race begins the day you turn 40 for what you will become the day you turn 60. And then I show myself, and actually, I want to tell you something. I love my little restricted diet. I love my little exercise routine. I love my coffee that I make so strong it would melt your socks off.
Randy.
I love the things I do, and for some reason, the life I've got, and I've done a little bit what this man has done. I've built a diary of kind of the great things it is about these restricted foods the doctor puts you on. I've just made them the best little fun things to eat there is. And I don't know. I think you can fill these squares in like the tiles on the floor, one way or the other. You can either make them serve you, or it can be a dreary old lonely day that's going to end with you being alone or whatever. Or you could think, tomorrow I get up and get to have another strong cup of coffee.
Oh, I love it, Randy. Ian.
I want to ask Randy a question, if I can.
Yeah.
What? So you enjoy, as I do, solitude and the so-called loneliness, you know, now that the kids have gone, now that, you know, the dog is aging and sort of wants to lie on the couch instead of come for a walk.
Right.
You've actually found you like the solitude and the loneliness.
Well, you know, I tell you what, I like going to social events as well, and I actually, at my age, I've tried to learn salsa dancing and other stuff too, and I'm not as fast at picking it up as other people, so I always have to take two cycles of the lesson. But you'll be at a social event with younger folks, and you know, yesterday they had a show on texting, and I was at a table with another person and they were texting, and finally I leaned over and said to the person, why don't you ask those folks you're texting what you should say to this annoying guy sitting here trying to talk to you.
And on that note, we're almost out of time. I'm afraid we have to go. Ian, thank you. We never got to talk about your children, and I wish we did. And I must say that I really want to read about your son, the book about your son.
They're in good shape. Thank you very much,
good.
Both of them.
Good.
And it's been a great pleasure talking to you, though.
And you as well. I didn't think we would laugh as much, but it was good. It's good to laugh about all of this, too.
That's no right. Maybe it's as my an older friend of mine, a now late friend of mine, who died at 90 a couple of months ago, said, your 60s, he said, forget about your 60s. He said, your 70s are the best decade you'll
ever have. All right. That's our heyday. It's still ahead. Our guest, Ian Brown, the book is 60, A Diary of My 61st Year. It's well worth a read. It's a lovely book. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley, young K.P. Whaley, for producing the hour, and the even younger and wonderful Scotty Myers for on-air production. They're in their heyday, I think. Or it's yet to come. Thanks for listening.